And in order to do this, we must study and practice the Dharma. And so this afternoon we are engaged in the study of the Dharma. And the Dharma that we are studying is the way of the Bodhisattva, entering the way of the Bodhisattva by the great being Shantideva. And in this text, the opening section is how to develop bodhicitta when you have not roused it. And the second part of the text is the how to preserve bodhicitta without weakening, and in fact increase it further and further. So we are in that second section. This section has two parts: a general discussion of the teaching of the six transcendences, and then discussions of the latter five transcendences. We are in the second. So we have, last year we discussed the practice of discipline. This year we are discussing the practice of patience. And in the discussion of patience, the chapter opens with just considering the results of anger. And by considering the results of anger, then we develop more enthusiasm, more interest, we realize how important it is for us to practice patience. And then the remainder of the chapter is talking about the practice of patience. It begins by discussing the causes of anger, and then eventually comes to the discussion of the different ways of practicing patience. Practicing patience when we ourselves are being harmed. Practicing patience when those we like, those on our own side in our own group, are harmed. And then practicing patience when our enemies are pleased or helped. Or there's also a section later that comes on that we'll get to next year about how to practice patience when your desires are frustrated. We won't have time to go through that. I could go through it. We'd go a little bit over. But I don't want to overload too much, and it seems better to me we'll stop in the middle of the chapter this year and then resume from the same place next year, impermanence willing. Gyalon Karmapa was talking about how he had met a Muslim. How does the story go exactly? The Muslim said, we always say, God willing, inshallah. And so we Buddhists should say, impermanence willing. So impermanence willing, and we have to keep that thought in mind because we have a short time here, a short time in this earth, even if it seems like a long time. Seems like our lives are long. We really don't have any idea how long they actually will be or what condition they'll be in, will be in for the rest of our lives. And so while we have this opportunity, we have to take it to practice the Dharma. And so you should really, on the one hand, really rejoice that you have actually begun to do this. This is extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. Think of how many billion people there are on the planet. Think of how many millions of them call themselves Buddhas. How many millions of them, how many thousands of those, or hundreds of thousands, actually think they're practicing Buddhism, but how few actually are. And so to have the opportunity to at least try. I mean, I'm not sure we can really say that we're practicing Buddhism well. Drupin Kempo Thabo Rinpoche, as those of you who went to Namo Buddha last year found, he'd say he doesn't really practice the Dharma. He's not really a practitioner, but he has an interest in practice. And this is someone who's, you know, from our perspective, it's like, wow, if we could only be like him. But from his perspective, looking at it, so we have to be honest with ourselves and see where we are and try to stretch ourselves more and more. And so right now, the portion of the text that we are considering is the discussion of practicing patience when those we like, things we like, people we like, are harmed or threatened or insulted and so forth. And we discussed a little bit about this. We talked about, we talked about the patience of contemplating the Dharma, and now we were talking about the patience of disregarding harm. And there is first a verse about thinking about why we single out the sentient for anger, and then a second about thinking about the whether or not the question of innocence and guilt. And now we have come to the verse 68. And verse 68 here, we are looking, 68 and 69, we're looking at the question of, we actually have to engage, look at our own or their own faults, whose fault it really is. Why in the past did they do acts that would make others harm them? Since everything depends on karma, why hold a grudge for the other? Realizing this, no matter what, I will endeavor at merit, so everyone will come to have mutually loving thoughts. So we see the people we like being harmed, and just as we described this morning, harm comes largely from karma from past lives, not exclusively. Karma is really complicated. And there are bad things that happen to us because of karma from past lives. There are bad things that happen to us from our actions in this life. For example, if you smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day and you get lung cancer, this is not the ripening of past karma. If you know that you have a tendency to high blood pressure and a history of heart disease in your family, and yet you continue to eat bacon and salt and fat and just revel in all that, and then you have a heart attack and a stroke and either die or have quadruple bypass surgery, that is not karma. That is what we call circumstance, your own actions in this lifetime. So there are differences. Not everything comes about because of karma. It's a very difficult mix. And this is, karma is so difficult that the Buddha said that really only the omniscient, that is only the Buddha, can really tell the whole idea of karma. When we understand karma, we understand just a tiny, tiny bit of it. So it's difficult. So you can't necessarily say that everything bad that happens is because of karma. But there is a lot that happens because of karma. And so when we see other people, people we love, being harmed by others, whether it be having a difficult time at work because someone's ganging up on them, whether they're being physically harmed, whether it's some other, if they're being harassed or something like that, when we see something like that, it may well be because of karma. Hard to say for certain. In any case, if it is from karma, it's because of their own acts in the past. Why in the past did they do acts that would make others harm them? They did something. Just as we discussed this morning, we did things that put others in a position that the acts, our own karma, act as a condition that made someone else harm us. So too with other people, when they act, their karma from the past acts as a condition that makes other people harm them. Now at the same time, that person who's doing the harm, if they were able to think clearly, then they couldn't make a choice. The question is how actually able are they to make a choice? It's difficult to say that they are. On some level, yeah, you could say they're responsible for it even if they can't stop themselves, but that's difficult. And how are we worrying about that? That other person who's being harmed, you could say, well, they're responsible for it too. That same logic applies to them because they could have stopped themselves in a past life from doing the harmful act that they did. So where do you look at responsibility? When you start playing the blame game, you're not helping anyone. Who's to blame? Who is it? Instead, we need to meditate on compassion for everyone, develop loving kindness and compassion for all sentient beings, even those who are just horrid people. No matter what they're doing, they're sentient beings, beings like us. So everything depends on karma. So why bear any grudge? And if we want to free ourselves from that, one of the best ways to free ourselves from that is by meditating on loving kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta. So as it says in verse 69, realizing this, no matter what, I will endeavor at merits, so everyone will come to have mutually loving thoughts. And what this is what is mentioned at this point is the karma, in the commentary, is the example of Maitreya, and it was one of his past lifetimes when he was called Gelong Lodra Tempa, Sthiramati was his name in a past life in Sanskrit, Lodra Tempa in Tibetan. And he had perfected he had meditated on loving kindness so much that he would just cross the threshold of a house and everyone in the household would start really because of the strength of his loving kindness, everyone else would really start meditating on loving kindness. In fact, his name, Maitreya, that comes from the Sanskrit word maitri, which means love, friendliness, loving kindness. These days we have between Nepal and certain sites in India, the Nepal-India Maitri buses. That means friendship in now in the current language, but we talk about it as loving kindness in terms of the Dharma. So this again gets back to what we were speaking about on Friday night and a little bit yesterday morning. That power of loving kindness, if we can really develop the strength of our loving kindness, then we'll actually be able to have a positive effect on other people just through, you know, the strength of that. For example, I mean, you've all met, many of you, you haven't all, many of you have met Kyabje Trungpa Rinpoche, and you've felt what it's like to be in his presence. Some of you might have had the fortune to meet the Dalai Lama, where you walk into his presence like, wow, it's just so. Gyalon Karmapa has a lot of loving kindness, but his energy is different. But so with beings like this, you find yourself in your presence, and it kind of rubs off on you. And if you do practices that develop loving kindness, then you'll find that other beings react to you differently. Now, I want other beings to react to me differently, so I'm going to meditate on loving kindness? No, ain't going to work. Even if it does work a little bit, it's not going to go very far. People will be able to suss you out. They know when you're faking it. You have to really develop that. It won't work. You have to really develop loving kindness solely for the sake of other sentient beings, and you'll find that that'll do a lot to not only tame the situations where you yourself might get angry, but also calm down situations where other people might get angry at you. Because when you're filled with loving kindness, your attitude, your physical expressions, the way you carry yourself is different. When you see someone, you say kind of a threat. It's loving kindness. It's like, wow. Loving people. And then people treat you differently. So that in itself goes a really long way to preventing the situations that could lead to either person getting angry. So this is one reason why loving kindness is so important. The other thing we have to do is we have to not only develop our qualities of loving kindness, we also have to we also have to make sure that we eliminate everything about ourselves that would destroy our merit, all the afflictions, all the problems. We have to try as best we can to decrease them, to decrease the afflictions, and then eventually to uproot the afflictions. As it says here, when fire that has burned one house spreads to another home, you gather up and throw away the straw and such that fuel it. Likewise, throw away instantly whatever you are attached to that fuels the fires of hatred, fearing it will consume your merit. So, when I first started going to India, and you can still sometimes see them, you can see the traditional construction houses, mud brick walls plastered with mud, or sometimes actually with cow manure on the outside, and then you'd have thatched roofs. Kind of low houses, a thatched roof. So, and you've probably, we used to have thatched roofs in, I don't know, did we have them in New England so much? We had more shingle roof. But in England and Germany, there are a lot of houses with thatched roofs. And you probably know what happens when a thatched roof catches on fire. They're nice roofs, very warm, keep the rain out, and they burn really well. So when you have a fire, you immediately in your house, you have to get rid of everything that's going to burn. Get it out of the house if you can. Otherwise, you're going to lose the house. Or maybe another way of looking at it is these days, when your neighbor's house catches on fire, what do? You go outside with a hose and wet down your roof. You know, that's what we do now. So you have to take care of it, get away of everything. Likewise, throw away instantly whatever you're attached to that fuels the fires of hatred. So like I mentioned on the first day, when you have something you're attached to, you have something that can cause anger. So this would be the things like your friends, your family, whatever it is. The more attachments you have, the more likely you're going to be to get angry about things. You're attached to your ideas. You're attached to your political beliefs. You're attached to everything. And the more stronger your attachment to those is, the more likely you're going to get angry. For example, if you are a Republican, and then one of the socialist libertarians starts saying something, then you're going to get angry at them because you're attached to your Republican views. And then the socialist libertarian is going to get angry at the Republicans because of their views. And so everyone's just getting angry. And it doesn't really matter what label or whoever it is, but the more attached we are to them, then, I mean, you look at what the situation in our country where it's just getting further and more polarized, and people are getting angry. And people talk about the difficulties they have in their families, dealing with people, other people who have different views in their families, and they just can no longer talk about certain topics because of what's going on, what has been going on in our country. And what does that come from? It comes from our attachment to our views. So if we want to be able to actually bridge that polarization, then we have to be able to actually talk to each other. And that means we have to give up our attachments. That's the political message of the day. I gave a political message this morning, didn't I? I'm getting too risque in my teaching. But at any rate, anything you're attached to, if you're attached to it, if you don't feel like you could actually give it away, you probably are better giving it away now before you know. It's like the less you're attached to things, the better off you're going to be. You're not attached to anything, no anger. Now another, so this is a way of preventing your merit from decreasing. And another way of thinking about it is that by practicing patience, now we can actually prevent suffering in the future. This is a verse talking about, too bad Jerry's not here to talk about the, he was asking about criminal justice this morning. So here we are, medieval criminal justice. What's wrong if someone condemned to death, their hand cut off, is freed? What's wrong with human suffering removing you from hells? So in the old days, if you stole enough wood, you'd get executed. So you've stolen the wood, and you're condemned to death, and then the king has mercy and cuts off your hand instead, lets you go. Are you going to be happy? Oh, God, I wasn't killed. Thanks, God. Wonderful. I'm still alive. I was afraid I was a goner there. Yeah, I don't have a hand anymore, but I'm alive. And so the same way, if we experience suffering now when we're bodhisattvas, as I was discussing this morning, when we experience suffering now, we experience the suffering now, we don't react in anger, we accept it, we bear with it, and because of that, we are freed from experiencing that type of suffering again in the future, in the hells. So, or the karmic results of that. So it's better to experience it here now while we're able to do it. Furthermore, the suffering when it ripens here is smaller than it would be were it to ripen in the hells. As verse 73 reads, if I cannot bear this amount of suffering in the present, why then do I not stop my anger, cause of hell's agonies? So right now we experience a little bit of suffering, and we think to ourselves, "Oh, this is too much. I can't deal with it. It's too much." But if we think out, actually, the suffering that we are going to experience in the future from our misdeeds is far greater than the suffering that we'll experience now as a human. We have a good ability to deal with it now. And when you read the descriptions of the hells, now here we're getting into a part that's hard for a lot of people. You hear the discussions of the hells where the black line hell, where black lines are kind of drawn on your body, and the excruciating, the reviving hell, crushing hell, the cold hells where you are frozen until you crack like a lotus, blistering and so forth. The descriptions of these hells sound horrific, and we don't imagine that they could possibly be so, and we don't, it sounds to us kind of like something they're just trying to scare us. So this is why it's so important for us to really contemplate the four thoughts that turn the mind when we begin our practice. It's just critical, and it's important to consider it over and over again. And the more you talk about it, the more you discuss it. If you have study groups about it, you think about it, you keep it in mind, you think about it all the time. And you think about it not saying, it is so, the Buddha said so. You think about it thinking, you got to be critical. You use your critical faculties. No one's saying turn off your intelligence. In fact, we're saying use your intelligence. The Buddha taught these. If you look at the quality of the acts that are said to result in hell, how does that ripen? How could that be? What is it going to be like? If you are acting out of hatred, what is that? And then how could that reflect back to you, as we were speaking about this morning, in terms of how karmic cause and effect may well work, psychologically at least? And so you think about that. You've got to really keep it in mind. Even if the particular sufferings of the hells, okay, maybe you are not going to be reborn in the incessant hell where you're boiled in a cauldron of molten iron or molten copper. Maybe that's not a specific punishment or a specific ripening, I should say. I shouldn't say punishment, a specific ripening of your karma. And yet, if you look at the act, if you look at the seed, the karmic seed, you can get a taste of the character of the karmic result. So see how is that going to be. And it's said to grow exponentially festers in your ground conscious, in your subconscious. And so when it ripens much stronger. I like to joke, the bank of karma pays a very high rate of compound interest. So you have to be careful about what you deposit. So when we think about it, I mean, what have we done? What are we accomplishing from our actions? And that's what the next two verses speak about. For sake of desire, 1,000 times I have experienced being burned in such an hell, but done no good for myself or others. But this is not that great a harm, and a great aim will be accomplished. It's right to only be delighted at pains that dispel harm to beings. So when you look around at the people and the animals that we can see, they act out of desire, and because of their desire, they do things that harm other sentient beings. They eat other animals. They kill. They act out of greed. They steal. They fight. They struggle, they do everything. There's nothing that humans and animals will not do to each other. And with humans in particular, because we are more intelligent, that gives us a greater capacity to do harm. And the more technology we get, the greater the harm that we're able to do. Where just 150, 200 years ago, people could, if they were fishermen, they could catch maybe a few thousand, if they had a good net, maybe 10,000 fish in a day. Now they can catch millions. Think about the amount of karma that they're doing now and how they're using it. People are now using different types of technology as ways to create divisions and set people against each other. And there's nothing to swindle people, steal money, steal credit card information, all the things that people do now, there's nothing that people won't do just to satisfy their desires. They want a little bit of money, and what good comes of it? In the future, then what are they going to experience as a result? And we think about it, in past lifetimes, if we've had an infinite number of lifetimes, we've done everything that we see all those other sentient beings do. There's nothing we haven't done in the past. And we've experienced the results of these in millions or billions or trillions of lifetimes over an infinite length of samsara. And it's done none of us any good. We're still here in samsara. We act out of desire, and then what do we get for it? Suffering and nothing else. So, and this has happened over and over again if we think about a limitless samsara. And we've experienced the karmic ripening of this many times, but it's not done anything for ourselves or others. We're still ordinary sentient beings. But when we're experiencing a harm now, compared to the harms we would experience in the hell, it's not that bad. It's not that hard a thing. And it will, in the end, because we're practicing patience, we'll be able to fill a great aim, a great goal. We have to become Buddhas. In order to become Buddhas, we need to be able to practice patience. And in order to be able to practice patience, we need to have people do bad things to us and the people we like. Otherwise, everyone's hunky-dory, it's nice, no patience, sorry. There's the story that there are many different versions of this story, so I'm not going to specify which master and where it was, because there are lots of versions of this story, and so I'm going to do a hybrid. Don't look it up anywhere, but you'll see something. If you read enough, you'll see a story similar to this, because I've heard at least two different versions with two different lamas. So this great lama was walking by a place, and he saw a meditator sitting by the stupa looking so holy. I said, "Oh, what are you practicing?" "I'm practicing patience," said the meditator. So then the master said, "What the heck? What do you think you're doing?" And started screaming at him and yelling at him, kicking dirt on his face and everything. And the other person started saying, "Why are you doing this? Why are you so angry?" And then the great master said, "I thought you were practicing patience." So patience isn't something that we can do on our own. You have to have someone who's going to do something that's going to make you angry. Otherwise, you can't be patient. That being said, if you then think, okay, you have to have someone to make you angry so you can be patient, so I'm going to wait for someone to be patient before I start thinking about this. I'm going to wait for someone to do something mean to me, and then I'm going to practice patience. You get to that point where someone's doing something mean to you, and it's like, oh, wait a minute. What am I supposed to do? Be patient? Oh, I'm forgetting. Because you haven't thought about it. So you have to actually take the time to really contemplate these teachings. If we don't take the time to contemplate these teachings, when we have no one doing anything harmful to us, or you can think about it where something in society where it's not too directly involved, but you know, like you see, I don't know, injustices, whatever, things that are wrong in society, things that make you angry, that get your goat, and you can practice patience on those. You can think about those as examples of how to practice patience, because frankly, in our society, we have a lot of people who get really worked up about politics, who get worked up about social issues. On the one side is socialists and so forth, the other side it's, you know, Bible issues or whatever. Whichever side you're on, it doesn't matter, because it's all anger and looking at others' faults and blaming other people. It doesn't matter which side you're on. It's all the same, essentially. It's just anger and all the secondary afflictions that come out of that. So that's an opportunity that you can say, someone's doing something bad. I'm going to, for example, you know, we can think about someone like Harvey. I'm going to be provocative. We can think about someone like Harvey Weinstein, who did a lot of horrible things. Are we able to be patient for someone like him? Can you have patience for that? If you can, then you're well trained. If you can't, it's understandable, because it's just the way things happen. But are you able to do that? If you find that you're not able to do that, take a step back. Leave Harvey Weinstein or whatever person fits in that category for you. Step back and work on something a little bit easier, something that's less maybe vitriolic for you, you know. Maybe if I'd said Harvey Weinstein a couple of years ago, people would have been even more up in arms as there than they are now. But if you can get to that point where you can see that someone like him was also driven by his own lusts, desires, delusions, and so forth. If you can get to the point where you can have compassion for someone like him, then you'll be better able to practice patience when something happens to you. And I'm not saying that this is going to be easy. But if we truly want to be able to practice patience, we have to do it in all those situations that cause us to get indignant, feel like things are unjustified, there's no justice, and so forth. Because these are the areas that are showing us that, what is the root? I mean, being indignant comes out of a feeling of aversion, not liking something. It comes out of displeasure. It's related to anger. So it's an area that we can practice patience with. So, and I want to make a caveat here. I'm not saying don't work for social justice. I'm not saying don't work for ending all forms of discrimination, abuse, and so forth. I am fully in the favor of ending all those. I am saying look at your own selves and what's happening in your own mind. That is what is most important. Develop that in your own mind, and then you'll be able to actually be more effective in your other things. As Milarepa was talking with Rechungpa on one of the songs, I don't remember which one. It's towards the end of the 100,000 songs, and Rechungpa was saying, "I need to go out and teach." And Milarepa said, "Think how much more benefit you're going to be able to do if you've achieved Buddhahood first." So, you know, the more we develop ourselves, the more good we're going to be able to do. So that's the, I'm getting a little bit too social maybe, I don't know. Okay, where did we get to? Yes. So now we have finished, that finishes the discussion about practicing patience when you and yours are harmed. And now we are into the section of when good things happen to your enemy. And this is a really difficult one for a lot of people. It's even harder to practice patience because some people just don't deserve the good they get. They get these good things and they really don't deserve it. Like when someone else is praised. If others are pleased when they praise someone as having qualities, why then, O mind, do you not as well praise them and take delight? Your pleasure from rejoicing is a blameless source of delight allowed by those with qualities, the best way to gather others. So what happens is someone says something about Mr. Powerful Political Figure that you despise. And Mr. Powerful Political Figure, maybe Mrs. Powerful Political Figure, let's not be sexist. Mrs. Powerful Political Figure, someone says something nice about them and you don't like Mrs. Powerful Political Figure and so you're upset about it. Mrs. Powerful Political Figure is kind of pleased by someone saying something nice. So what you're doing is you're training yourself in anger when someone else is being happy. But we've taken the Bodhisattva vow. We want all sentient beings to have Buddhahood and until then enjoy happiness. Oh, wait a minute. This is a little bit different than your action. Your action is like, I want them to be happy in the short term and Buddhas in the future. And yet when they are happy, you're disappointed. And rejoicing is actually the cheapest way to gather virtue, because you just get to sit there and say, oh, it's so wonderful that they're doing it. And you get the same amount of merit as the person who's doing the action. So you see someone doing something, some pleasing someone else, you say, oh, how wonderful that person is, and being genuine about it. And I say, oh, how wonderful that Mrs. Powerful Political Figure is getting this. Yeah. So your pleasure from rejoicing is a blameless source of delight allowed by those with qualities. The best way to gather others. So allowed with those with qualities. Those with qualities means the Buddhas. The Buddhas would teach the precepts to the Buddha, the precepts, like the precepts of the Bodhisattva and so forth, the things you're allowed to do and the things you're not allowed to do if you have a certain vows. So when you're teaching, this is something you're allowed to do. You're allowed to rejoice. So you may. And when you do, actually rejoicing, it's in some ways it's kind of nicer than actually doing the action. I mean, when you really rejoice in the good action that someone else has done, it's just like, how wonderful. It's even though you're not actually doing anything with your body or your speech, well, of course you can. You can clap your hands, you can say excellent with your speech, and so forth. You can rejoice physically, but if you're just sitting there saying, how wonderful, it's just so lovely. I highly recommend it. If you want a feel-good Buddhist practice, rejoicing is it. Now, of course, Buddhist practice is not about feeling good in the present, but there's no denying that some practices are just quite enjoyable. Rejoicing is one of those. But sometimes we are so stuck on Mrs. Powerful political figure that we don't want anything. And you say, so you might think to yourself, but it's going to make people I don't like happy also. But others will be happy too. If you don't want this joy, you stop being pages and will thus destroy. You stop paying wages and will thus destroy the seen and unseen. So if you don't want the joy that the other person has and also the joy that you gain, if you don't want that joy, then it's like you've stopped paying yourself wages. For example, when we're bodhisattvas, we treat our bodies like servants. And if you're going to have a servant, you have to take care of your body, which means you have to pay it with food and clothing. Not too much, not too nice, but if you don't give it its wages, it's going to get sick and die. You got to pay your body its wages. You also have to pay your mind its wages. And so the wages that your mind need are merit. So like when you do something good and it creates good feeling in you, a good karma, when it plants a good karmic seed, that's like you've put something in your mind's 401k account at the bank of karma. Again, high rates, compounding interest. Okay? So you do that, and that's paying the wage. And if you don't, otherwise it'll destroy the seen and unseen. So destroying the seen refers to things that you might experience in this life. In other words, that you would see, results that you would see in this lifetime. The unseen means those lives that are those results that would come in future lives that you can't see in this life. So you'll see in a lot of Buddhist texts, some translators are less literal about this than me, but I kind of like the seen and unseen. So the seen is what you experience in this lifetime. The unseen is what comes in the future. When that deposit ripens. And so, and also when you, the other thing that happens is that when you are unhappy about others being praised, then actually all you're doing is creating suffering for yourself, as it teaches in the next couple of verses. When yours are the qualities described, oh, sorry. I got the verses wrong. That's what this verse is happening to talking. But others will be happy to you if you don't want this joy. You stop paying wages and will thus destroy the seen and unseen. And the others means other people. The two means that it also includes yourself. So then when you get to the next verse, when yours the qualities described, you want that others be pleased. When others' qualities are described, you don't want to be pleased yourself. So it's actually, as I said, rejoicing is a cheap way to gain merit. And if you're giving that up, it's like you're saying, I don't want to be happy right now. I'd rather be angry than happy, which is not really a logical thing to do if what we really want for ourselves is to be happy. Now the next... The next stanza about how is about sometimes we have trouble bearing it when other people, when people we don't like, our enemies, gain some happiness, something good. And it reads, if you want for beings the Buddhahood adored in the three worlds, why does it gall you so to see them have some paltry honor? So we say, I'm taking the Bodhisattva vow. You have to remember this is the basis, right? We're talking about practicing the Bodhisattva practice. So you have the Bodhisattva vow. The Bodhisattva vow is to bring all sentient beings to Buddhahood. And as it says at the end of the third chapter of this text, it says, today in the presence of all protectors, I invite all sentient beings as my guests to Buddhahood, and till then happiness. God's demigods and everyone rejoice. So we're saying, we bring them to Buddhahood, and until they get to Buddhahood, may they be happy. So you say, I want all sentient beings to be happy, except for Mrs. Powerful Political Figure, or whoever it is that you're angry about. So when they get some paltry arna, when you think about it, actually, someone even gets the Nobel Prize, and that's we think that's a great honor, but actually it's really pretty minor in comparison to things. You get, a million kroner and some sort of something to put in your room that you don't have room to actually put it there, especially if a small room. And I mean, what good is another thing to put on your mantelpiece? And a million kroner, I mean, so what? It sounds like a lot to us now, but actually, if you think about it karmically, you may have those million kroner and you may invest them well and end up with 10 million kroner. But in the end, how much of it can you take with you? None. It's not going to last. The joy that you have when you rejoice, that action of rejoicing may seem small, but it is going to ripen as far more happiness in the future. And happiness doesn't depend upon a million kroner or $1 million or a million whatevers. Even a million rupiah. Indonesian rupiahs are not worth much anymore. So that's that. The other thing is when we have someone whom we don't like who gets something, we get unhappy about it. In particular, the next couple, next three stanzas are about kind of about a monastic practice. When monks and nuns would go for alms, one monk might be given something nice by a patron or a sponsor, and then another monk is not given something nice, and that other monk is saying, they got that really nice fabric. Look at that. That's amazing fabric. I wish I had my robes getting a little threadbare. I want fabric like that. And they got So that's specifically what's being talked about here. If they get something or it remains inside the patron's house, in either case, it is not yours, given or not, why care? So there's that nice fabric. The patron could either keep that fabric, beautiful homespun cotton. You know how long it takes to spin cotton? It's really valuable. Cotton was an incredibly valuable commodity. Cloth was incredibly valuable in the time of the Buddha. And there are lots of stories about how difficult, think about it. You had to spin everything yourself. There were no factories. You couldn't go to the fabric store and buy bolts of acrylic. You had to do everything yourself, and then you had to dye it. It was a lot of work and very rare. And so cloth was a really prized possession. So for a monk to get a new Dharma robe or cloth to make a new Dharma robe was like, wow. Or for a nun, I should say a monastic. Sorry, please excuse me for my habits. If you have that cloth, if it's given to the other person, it's not yours. If the patron doesn't give it to anyone, it's not yours. What's the difference to you? You still don't have it. It's exactly the same. Now, you might still want it, but that's another thing. Why do you throw away your merits, your faith, and qualities? Tell why you're not angry at the one who doesn't hold on to their gains. So you get angry at that other monk or nun for getting that nice piece of cloth. You don't get it. You get angry, and by getting angry and being being unable to bear it, what do? You accumulate negative karma. You cancel out your merit. You destroy your qualities. You disrupt your, because you're angry and displeased, you disturb your mind, which means you can't sit in meditation. You disrupt all of your study and so forth. You can't listen, contemplate, or meditate. What have you done? You've just destroyed it all yourself. And who did that? It was you yourself. It was by getting angry is the one who did it. So tell me why you're not angry at the one who doesn't hold on to their gains. So actually, if you're going to be angry at anyone, you should be angry at yourself, because you're the one who's doing this. You're the one who's made that situation. The other person, the other monastic who got that lovely piece of cloth, has no idea that you really wanted that piece of cloth, and it's really not their business anyways. And the patron was giving it out of faith. They're trying to do something good. They weren't particularly thinking, oh, I'm going to not give anything to that karma tribala. I'm going to go give it to someone else. No, they're just thinking, oh, here's a piece of cloth to give to this monastic. So it's not. So it's you're the one who is losing. It's not the other. So do you not only feel no sorrow for the wrongs you've done yourself, but also want to vie against those who have performed merit? So not only do you feel badly about this, but you think that you're somehow on a level with those people who, the other monk, who's a monk or nun, the other monastic, I'm trying to train myself, the other monastic who is receiving this this gift because it's the result of their merit from the past. They have merit. And so you're doing indulging in negative merit and thinking that you can somehow equal or become the same as that other person. This is kind of a ludicrous way of thinking. It just doesn't go like that. So even if where did we get to? Wait a minute, I'm getting confused about these headings. Oh, I kind of misread the headings at lunch. Well, we've got time. We've got some time. So we can also, completes the section on practicing patience why am I getting so confused today? Well, I'm going to go a little bit further. Now, another time when we get upset is when something bad could happen to our enemies, but doesn't. Might be. Mrs. Powerful political figure might be got out of office somehow. How is it? This is the wrong state to say that, I realize, isn't it? Maybe I better go back to Mr. Powerful. Mr. Powerful political figure. Oh, I know, I can just say Boris Johnson. It's easy, we're not English. No, I can't use anyone. Oh, I'm just gonna get myself in hot water, whoever I use. I think you're fine. I think I'm fine. We don't know who's closeted, you know. In this atmosphere, you might have to be support someone and feel like you can't say it, which wouldn't be good. And people have different opinions, and people, they come to their opinions for different reasons. And when we kind of get so tribal and we divide people into groups and we don't feel like we can get along. Now, I understand that many Western Buddhists have a certain political persuasion, but not all. In fact, some of the better, some of the great supporters of Kenpo Jigme and Kenpo Lobsang are, in fact, Republicans. And they can't understand why people don't like Trump. Sorry. You know. So what is it? It's all in our mind. So even when enemies are displeased, what's there for you to enjoy? The wishes in your mind alone won't cause them any harm. So even if something happens that enemy, that's probably the safest word to use, enemy is displeased, then what good does it do to you? You make them displeased, you do something that makes, something happens that gives them a hard time. What joy is there for you? Because it doesn't do anything. You might wish that something happens to your enemy. You might wish that they're removed from office in some way, votes or whatever. And if it does, that wish in your mind isn't what made it happen. It's just negativity in your own mind. How would it please you to accomplish the pain you wish for them? You say you would be satisfied. What greater ruin than that? So you'd be happy when someone else is made unhappy. I mean, this is completely the opposite of the Bodhisattva vow. The Bodhisattva vow is to make all sentient beings happy and to bring them to Buddhahood. Till Buddhahood, until then happiness. Invite all sentient beings as my guests. Please come. I'm going to make you happy. This includes everyone, even the powerful political figures that you don't like, right? So if you are rejoicing that they're unhappy, that's bad. Now, you can be, so you have to look at yourself, look at your own mind, because it's so easy, especially when we get to these things for the afflictions, to masquerade as something positive. We think they're good. We think we're right. We're judging other people. We're looking at other people. We think, we know. It's not just we think we're right. We know we are right. Of course we're right. We know that. And that gets us to think in negative ways about other people. In particular, other people, especially when we come to politics. And we are unable to sympathize with them. When something bad happens to them, we're like happy. An example is when Osama bin Laden was killed by a Democrat in office. I don't know about the soldiers who actually did the killing. So you can't say that the Republicans and Democrats are any better than each other on this one. When a Democrat had Osama bin Laden killed, the news was announced and people cheered and danced in the streets. What could there be? I mean, if you were among those people dancing in the streets, what were you doing? You were rejoicing in people doing something that harmed another sentient being. It doesn't matter how harmful that other sentient being. Of course, you have to do things that prevent other sentient beings, other people and other sentient beings from harming if you're able. But when someone does something harmful, killing, stealing, if you rejoice in that, then you're just throwing everything away, completely breaking the Bodhisattva vow. So it's really important not to do this. It says, unbearably sharp the hook cast by the fishermen, the afflictions. Caught on it, surely I'll be cooked in cauldrons by hell's keepers. So it's like that hook. The afflictions is really sharp, and you don't notice it when it first goes in. You don't really notice that it's an affliction often. It's like, because you think you're right. So the point about all of this is that really, when we are looking for faults, you only look for faults in yourself. When you are looking for qualities, you always look for qualities in other people. And if you look, you might see them if your vision is pure enough. the eighth Karmapa, Mikyo Dorje says this in his instructions for the Lord of Kurapa and his sons, which is, I did a draft translation of, but I haven't been able to finish it for various reasons. And in it, there's one part where he says, you should always look at your own faults and look for qualities in others. And when you see a quality in someone else, you should rejoice because qualities in others are as rare as Buddhas. Looking to actually see. So how many times do you actually look at someone and say, oh, look at that quality? Particularly when you're looking at your enemies, Mr. Powerful, Mrs. Powerful, political figure, your boss, your horrid coworker, whoever it is, can you see any qualities in that person? If you are looking at that person and seeing faults, it's better to look away and look inside yourself. Chances are you'll see the same faults in yourself as you see the other person. Other teachings talk about how when we perceive other people, we perceive faults in other people, we're perceiving our own faults. When you think about it, as we were discussing this morning, everything we see is our own projection. When we see other people, we aren't really seeing who they are. We can't see who they are because we're too clouded by our own preconceptions, by our own thoughts, by our own ignorance. We aren't seeing other people. Literally, what we're seeing is just an image that comes into our mind. And that image is then clouded by all our thoughts about that other person. And those thoughts about other people, on some level, often seem like they're kind of right, and so we assume that they're really right. But actually, they're not. All of our thoughts are inherently confused. They're inherently mistaken. That's the nature of thoughts. It's mistaking the nature of things as being self and other, and seeing there's being a separation between ourself and the other person. I'm good. Mr. or Mrs. Horrible political figure, powerful political figure is bad. I'm good, the oppressor is bad. I'm good, the sinner is bad. Whatever way we're looking at it, whatever angle we're coming at it, we're dividing things, dividing people into us and them. And as long as we're dividing people into us and them, we're just going to be creating more bad karma for ourselves. So it's really important to recognize this. And that little ignorance of mistaking that, and then we get into this little bit of dislike. We don't recognize that displeasure, and then it grows into either anger, envy, indignation, something else. Something that's naturally just going to be afflicted. And when that happens, then there's no way that we can actually really see the other person or see ourselves. The affliction has disturbed our mind. Our minds are disturbed, so we can't really do anything effective to benefit the situation. So what's most important is to look inside ourselves. When you start seeing faults in others, remember, look inside yourself for the faults. Look for qualities in others. This is an important thing that we need to do. Otherwise, we're just going to keep going on in the same cycles of this and that. Now the problems that we see, when we look at this, the problems that we see, this problems of discrimination, sexism, racism, all the other problems, they are problems in our society. They are difficulties in our society, and they need to be overcome. We need to have a better, more just society where people are all able to be happy. Because right now we're in a society where a lot of people have difficulty because of the social structures. And frankly, we're all of us as white people are on one side of that generally, some more than others. I mean, especially for someone like me coming from half of my family is Southern aristocracy. So, you know, I've definitely had slaveholders in my past. And I don't know about the other side of the family. There might have been people who were involved in the slave trade. So my position now is definitely due, at least in part, to the oppression of African Americans, and certainly due to the extermination of the Native Americans who lived on the East Coast. But my karma had me born here now in this situation. So when we're in this situation, we have to recognize it. We have to recognize the situation. We have to work on ourselves so that we don't contribute to that in any way. And that means that we have to be mindful, aware, careful. Do not do any misdeeds. Do not do any misdeeds. Practice abundant virtue and completely tame your own mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. If we can do this, then we're going to go a long way towards actually dealing with the social difficulties that we are in. But it starts with ourselves. Even if we feel like we need to do action outside, we have to do it inside, because otherwise we have to work inside. Otherwise, we're just going to be acting out of anger and frustration, which in the end cannot be truly constructive. So that is the situation. It's really, we have to be careful. You have to be honest with yourself. So I think that this is a good stopping place for this year.